keeping you a step ahead of the changing world of business. This is Voice America Business.
Welcome to CIO Talk Radio with your host, Sunjo Gall. All comments, views, and opinions expressed on this show are strictly those of the host, guest, and callers. Here's Sunjo Gall.
Good afternoon, and welcome to CIO Talk Radio. To learn more about the show, please visit www.ciotalkradio.com. Today's topic is impending IT workforce vacuum. What's the plan? Our guests for today's show are Ed Lazowska and Dr. Merrick First. Ed is the Bill and Melinda Gates Chair, Computer Science and Engineering, University of Washington, and he's also the former co-chair of President Bush's Information Technology Advisory Committee. And Dr. Merrick First is a distinguished professor and associate dean of College of Computing at Georgia Tech. Good afternoon, panel. Welcome to the show.
Great to be here.
So what's the plan for Christmas?
Well, in the Seattle area, what we're trying to do right now is get our power restored after last week's storm. And once the lights are back on, we'll be thinking about the holidays.
Okay, you've got a bigger problem to fight, right?
800,000 homes were without power for the past few days.
That doesn't sound so good.
No.
Yes, so let's talk about another big problem, which is impending. Hopefully your power situation will be taken care of shortly, but we have this bigger problem which is coming up, which is respect to IT workforce vacuum. What we mean by that is, like, by 2010 and 2015, I mean every 5 to 10 years, you'd see a mass exodus of IT workers who are primarily the baby boomers, which will create a huge vacuum. And we do not have ready replacements at mid-level who could replace the retiring talent, nor do we have the IT entrants being produced the right quality and quantity for a long-term replacement solution. And given that this is not something which we just were told about yesterday, it has been known to us for quite a while, but we have not taken a so-called collaborative effort from all different directions so that this could be handled effectively. What's happening here?
So this is Ed Lazowska in Seattle. Let me put a few numbers behind the points you've made, because they're very important, and you've described it precisely correctly. I think there's a misimpression about that there is a shortage of IT jobs. And indeed, during the tech downturn of 2000 and 2001, there were a set of people who lost their employment. But it's important for folks to understand that since 2004, employment in IT in the United States reached an all-time high and has been climbing steadily. And the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics does employment projections over a 10-year horizon. Their projections are that of all of the jobs in all fields of science and engineering between now and 2014, and that even includes the social sciences, so engineering, the social sciences, life sciences, physical sciences, math sciences, and computing, 71% of all new jobs in all fields of science and engineering between now and 2014 will be for what they call computer specialists, and 60% of all available jobs, which means both newly created jobs and jobs made available due to retirement, will be in computing. So there is, in fact, an enormous projected demand in this nation over the next 8 years for people in computing. And it's also important to realize, and I'm sure Merrick will talk about this in a few minutes, that computing is now necessary for a far broader range of occupations than it was in the past. Many people working in biological science applications need to have a deep knowledge of computing, people in the financial industry, so that creates an additional demand for these folks. So it's really important for employers and parents and students to understand that computer science is a great preparation for anything and that there is a remarkable shortfall in people to take on these jobs in the coming years.
Let me add to that. I think it's really important to point out that it's not just the retiring workers that are creating a vacuum. It's the creation of new types of jobs and new types of roles in those jobs. If you look at the list of fastest growing jobs listed by Fortune magazine, 6 out of the top 20 are in the computer field. And if you look at the College Board, the SAT people stats, half of the ones that they list as being the fastest-growing new jobs for people with bachelor's degrees are in the computer field.
Right. So to put a point on that, looking again at these Bureau of Labor Statistics projections, For newly created jobs in all fields of science and engineering, 15% are for engineers, whereas for new jobs plus net replacements, it's 22%. So engineers have a relatively greater rate of retirement projected over the next 8 years. For computing, it's 71% of all newly created jobs and 60% of new jobs plus net replacements. So there are these dual prongs, just as Merrick says.
Now, when we talk about the fact that, you know, the world is becoming global, you know, there's the boundaries have blurred. So what United States wants to do essentially is that whatever the high-end jobs are where your idea and intellect and innovation related work that needs to be done, it could be very well done here in the United States, and that we have been taking pride in. And then as soon as we see any kind of manual or administrative work that needs to get done, we would like to outsource that. With that being the new paradigm, we would essentially, by just based on that, it seems like we would need fewer people here. And on also, most of them would be at the top level. But we are also going to become over-reliant on an outside agency and or set of companies or a different nation for whatever, for what it's worth, with different political and other kind of risks that they may have. And we want to run our country based on that, because while we may have all the ideas and the management skills here, but if the execution function is sitting somewhere else, which is to an extent out of our control, how could we ever be comfortable, and what's our plan B for whatever, if in case we have a problem?
Well, let's separate out two important things you've said. One is the nature of the jobs that will be in this country, and the other is insulating ourselves against an excessive reliance on offshore, because I think those are closely related, but we can talk about them separately. You pointed out that top-level jobs will be in this country. Also, I think many customer-facing jobs will stay in this country. One thing Tom Friedman said in his book, The World is Flat, which I think everyone has read by now, is that it's never been particularly advantageous to be mediocre, but 10 years ago and 20 years ago and 30 years ago, you could be mediocre at your job and live in the United States and still pull down a pretty good living. And these days, if you're mediocre, they're probably going to find someone somewhere else in the world who can do that job better. And that's a really important point, and it talks about directly to the role of education, education throughout the education system, including continuing education. People who are growing up and employed in the United States have got to stay current in order to stay employed. And it's important to understand that point.
Right. Let me just add a couple of things. One is the numbers are actually not so bad. I mean, it sounds scary on the face of it that these jobs are being outsourced, and they are moving offshore, and there are definitely reduced barriers. This is Friedman's big point, is that with the kinds of technologies that are now available to us and available to almost everyone, you can take tech jobs which require, let's say, a narrow set of skills, and you can farm them out almost anywhere. But the actual numbers of those jobs that are actually currently being farmed out is relatively small. I mean, the current estimate there is like 2 to 3% of the IT workforce, which when you compare that with normal year-to-year fluctuations is actually not a very big number. So that being said, Friedman says, on the other hand, the number is going to get potentially a lot larger very fast, because there are a very large number of people being trained very well in places like Asia, in places like India and China. And the barriers to their being able to get this kind of work is slim. So the puzzle for us, for the United States, it's not just a question of mediocrity, which is definitely a big issue. You have to be able to compete head-to-head. It's a question of what do we do to create people for the workforce whose jobs are more difficult to outsource. So how do they become, because the outsourcing is not just a matter of losing the jobs, it's also decreasing the value of the jobs. If there are lots and lots of people who can do the same work and they can do it from someplace else, the value of that work is going to decrease no matter what. So what are we doing to train people to go into the IT workforce in a way that they can then become, they can maintain that promise. So we train them and then they can have middle class lifestyles or better for their entire working lives.
Right. Let me talk about three different companies in this context, three classes of companies. The first is Microsoft and Google, both of which I'm very familiar with. When they offshore...
Is that because you're in Seattle?
Well, we wish Google would be bigger in Seattle, but yeah, exactly. You know, when Microsoft and Google offshore, it is not for cost reasons, it's for access to talent reasons. And that is the predominant reason that these companies are offshoring is that they can't find enough domestic talent. So again, that's the focus of this show, and we'll talk more about that. I had an interesting discussion with the CIO of Nordstrom, another great Seattle company, a few months ago, and they offshore about 15% of their IT. But again, it's not for cost reasons. It's to provide stability to the Seattle-based workforce. They have 500 people in Seattle, a very big IT department, and as long as those people are productive and advancing in their careers, they're not subject to the variations that come as projects start and projects end. That's all handled by expanding and contracting the offshore workforce. A third example is Dell. Michael Dell was up in Seattle a couple of weeks ago and had dinner with a number of us, and he mentioned that Dell is bringing all of its call center work back to the United States now because customers were complaining about the quality of support they were getting. So I think that one has to take both a long-range view about where our nation is headed and where our kids are headed, but also, just as Merrick said, not overly dramatize the extent to which offshoring is taking place or the reasons that it's taking place.
Now, coming back to our, the workforce vacuum issue where the baby boomers are in the center stage, can we possibly inventory the typical job profiles that these people, have assumed or are assuming, which are being basically looked for in terms of replacement that is needed when they go? Are they specifically mid-management, senior management, or a bunch of coders when it comes down to IT? Let's inventory them and see what is the kind of plan that we need to have in place for the replacement and what is being done about it. So please stay tuned. We'll be right back after these messages.
The bottom line in business talk. Voice America Business.
Looking for flexible ways to scale your IT efforts? Then visit www.aval.com today. Aval is a professional services firm with a mission to help companies align information technology with their business objectives through its full line of staffing and outsourcing services. Whether it's hiring top technology talent or developing mission-critical business solutions, we back it up with an unconditional, positive ROI guarantee. To find out how Aval can help your company, visit www.aval.com or call 1-800-947-2832. Aval, making IT better. www.aval.com. Visit today. With 55 million blogs and counting, blogging is no longer just for anxiety-ridden teenagers or unemployed pundits with too much time on their hands. Companies are joining the blogosphere by the dozens. Corporate blogging is no longer optional. But how do you take your first steps into the blogosphere? On the Corporate Blogging Show, host corporate and CEO blogging consultant Debbie Weil, author of the corporate blogging book, talks in practical terms, no techie talk allowed, with some of the savviest practitioners of this new way of marketing and communicating online. Learn how you can incorporate all the newest social media tools, including blogs, podcasts, and online video, into your website and have fun while you're doing it. Yes, this wild new weekly world of blogs is supposed to be fun. The Corporate Blogging Show with Debbie Weil, broadcast each Tuesday at noon Pacific, 3 p.m. Eastern, on the Voice America Business Channel. The Corporate Blogging Show, your no-nonsense guide to the blogosphere.
Keeping you a step ahead of the changing world of business. This is Voice America Business.
You are listening to CIO Talk Radio. If you have a question or comment, call toll-free 866-472-5790. Now back to the show. Here's Sanjo Gal.
Welcome back to the show, folks. For listeners who have just tuned in, today's topic is impending IT workforce vacuum. What's the plan? Our guests for today's show are Ed Lazowska and Dr. Merrick First. Ed is the Bill and Melinda Gates Chair, Computer Science and Engineering, University of Washington, and he's also the former co-chair, President Bush's Information Technology Advisory Committee. And Dr. Merrick First is a distinguished professor and associate dean of the College of Computing at Georgia Tech. Before the break, we wanted to talk about the typical job profile that a baby boomer might be having or assuming at this time, which has to be replaced, and accordingly, what kind of talent mid-management or, you know, new entrant kind of talent that we have to develop so that they can effectively replace the baby boomers when they walk out.
Right. I think there are different ways to look at that question. One is to look at it by, let's say, position in the organization. Is it a senior management position? Is it a mid-level management position? Is it an engineering position? Is it a visioning position? Is it design? And it's almost surely the case that the older the workforce is, the people that we're looking at retiring are more likely to be biased towards the management roles. And I don't know that for sure. I don't know the statistics on that. Maybe Ed knows something more about that. But the other way to look at this is what types of jobs are people holding right now that are leaving? Because what we see happening more than the roles is the type of job. So, for example, in most of these organizations, as we're talking to companies about what kinds of people they'd like us to produce, we're hearing that it's not the narrow skill set that's so valuable. It's the ability to problem solve, it's the ability to bring sets of tools to bear and understand what the business context is. People who are leaving the workforce, part of what they're taking with them is the knowledge about what the business structures are like and why it is that they're doing what they're doing. It's not so much that they're able to program in a certain language or they have a certain set of skills that they bring to bear.
This is critically important. You know, it's hard for people to realize this, but the need to learn how to learn, how to keep learning throughout your life is more important in computing than in any other field because the narrow tools that you use become obsoleted in computer science faster than in any other field. So while employers, if you read the newspaper, always want the language du jour or the development environment du jour, you know, maybe it's Java, some Web 2.0 thing today, Ajax, the fact is that what they want to employ is people who are going to stay current, and it's more important than in absolutely any other field. The other thing I'd note is that when you survey alumni, and I know the University of Washington does this and Georgia Tech does this, with every passing year, when you ask them what contributed to their success, the precise subject they majored in matters less to them. What matters more to them is these skills such as abstract reasoning, conflict resolution, analysis and synthesis. These abilities that you learn from a great bachelor's program that makes people valuable for life. And again, that is what people take out of the workforce when they leave. It's the business context.
I think that's exactly right. I mean, for better or for worse, our field, you know, what you learn now is obsolete in 3 years from a functioning operational point of view. So as people leave the workforce, what they know about the technology, I think, is relatively, it's not so much that it's replaceable, but you would have to replace it anyway, whether they learned it or new people coming on board were to learn it.
I mean, when you look at the companies who have actually started using outsourcing, or using the outsourcing bandwagon to run their IT, typically what they want to do is to have, of course, a senior management, a couple of middle management positions. Then they may have a few core employees who may have at least almost all the skills that they would need to run the execution front, and then they would just scale out into a different country, and that is how they would want to run their shops. So with that being said, given the baby boomer who needs to walk out, they mostly would be expected to be working with some of the legacy technologies, or if they have picked up the main technologies, they would be left as one few core people who simply had too much business knowledge for them to be let go prematurely, and those are the people who we would have to replace. So essentially, you're not replacing a technology, a geek. You're replacing a person who's got equal or better business knowledge, and the plan needs to be somewhere in that direction where the person who's been brought on board is not just not coming with a vanilla technology know-how, but also the business knowledge. And that knowledge transfer sessions or the approach to knowledge transfer has to be looked at and closely monitored to see what's going on. So,
right.
I mean,
this is just incredibly important. I mean, it's the number one thing we hear from recruiters. It's the number one thing we learn from our graduates when they come back and talk to us. The most valuable thing is, I mean, yes, of course, it's important that they know how to problem solve. That's a given. It's important that they know a set of skills when they first come out. Most organizations train people on the specific sets of technologies they need when they arrive. It's understanding why it is they're building what they're building. It's understanding why it is they're managing what they're managing from the point of view of understanding what the value is to the organization that they're joining. That's the part that really adds value.
You know, something Nordstrom does, I mentioned them before, is everybody in their IT department works the floor during sales, right? Because they want the people, the 500 people in the Seattle Nordstrom IT department, to actually understand who's using the systems they deploy and how they're being used. And the only way for them to get that appreciation is to actually do the job. I want to put a point on something we've been discussing, which doesn't at all contradict what you've been saying, but do remember that the IT workforce deficit that we're facing is due even more to the creation of new jobs than to retirements. But the characteristics that people want for new employees are very similar. They want them to understand the context in which the technology works. So whether you're talking about a new employee or a replacement for a retiree, you're talking about the same broad set of skills. You have to be technically capable, but you have to have an appreciation for the context.
Yeah, the other thing I would say is it's yesterday's news that what's being outsourced is our narrow skill sets. Today's news is that what's being outsourced includes, and Ed has already said this by describing what Google and Microsoft are doing, today's news is that what's being outsourced is innovation as well, because the talent for that exists worldwide.
And let's look at this phenomena about acquisition of skills for the people, or for the type of people who have got big picture thinking. Can we safely say that this is something which is an acquired skill, or we are born with? Because if we are born with it, then the problem becomes worse. But if it is an acquired skill of being able to look at the big picture, then we definitely have to have a much better, or a much more, you can say, elaborate program for educating these people, whether they are at mid-management who are going to assume baby boomers position or the new entrants, to be able to be ready for this kind of work and this kind of expectation that owners, the business owners and the organizations will have on them.
Right. This is not only something you can teach. This is something that you have to teach, because otherwise you risk becoming completely obsolete, and you risk what we've actually been facing in computer science is people aren't even interested in the last 5 years to moving into the computer science degree programs, because they perceive them as being programs that teach narrow skill sets, which then can be, for example, outsourced. So you can absolutely teach, I don't know if it's a big picture, but you can teach what we call a more horizontal view. So to understand what it is that you're doing in your job that brings value. So if you're sitting in front of a machine and you're just hacking on a certain type of code at a certain level within the system, or you're managing a certain piece of the IT infrastructure, that's a narrow job function that has a certain set of skills that are valuable today, but of decreasing value, both because there's pressure to have it done externally and it's also changing very fast. More importantly is if you can understand horizontally what is it that you're bringing to the organization. So, for example, if you're working in the entertainment industry and you understand that what you're trying to do is bring a certain experience to the people who are being entertained, or if you're working in the security industry and you understand that what you're trying to do is bring a certain level of security, that requires, in order to do that, that requires understanding how a mix of technologies, some of which you're working with on a day-to-day basis and some of which you're managing others to provide for you, are providing for that value. And changing what the educational structure is to make it possible to produce people who understand the world in that more horizontal and less vertical way is actually something we spent a lot of time at Georgia Tech and the College of Computing doing. We even completely reinvented our undergraduate program around a new program called Threads, which I'd be happy to talk about, that is exactly in the business of training students to get their minds around this kind of horizontal or broader or thinking.
I mean, given the kind of curriculum that the students and their parents are used to seeing from a technology institute, if you were to kind of lay out the salient features of the program that you're just referring to, would that be shot down as a pie in the sky?
Well, sort of, we're getting the exact opposite response. So everywhere from Thomas Friedman's book, where he spent a whole chapter talking about the right stuff that we're doing at Georgia Tech, to what we're just seeing on the from feet on the ground from the people applying to our program, most places are experiencing a decline. I mean, when you say there's a sucking sound or a big problem in the IT industry, what you're maybe left out, or what's really important, is it's not only that the jobs are being created or being left by people who are going out, It's that we're not producing enough people to fill those jobs, so those jobs are going wanting. And the scary thing for people like Bill Gates, who are looking around and seeing that there were declining, was that there was a serious decline in enrollments in computer science programs. So, what we're seeing actually is last year we had a 25% increase in enrollment in the College of Computing for bachelor's students. And the reason is that this is the kind of thing that students are telling us that they want to do. They don't want to come in and become just narrow people who can execute narrow skill sets. They would like to be able to be people who can bring value in a this more horizontal way. So our experience so far is not that it's pie in the sky, but in fact that everybody seems to be gravitating towards it.
I think it would actually be helpful if Merrick described both the threads and the roles, because the Georgia Tech curriculum is nationally unique, and it's really leading us all.
Well, sure. Thanks for saying that, Ed. Well, let me tell you, there are two parts to this. The roles part is separate from the threads part. Let me tell you about the roles. When a student comes in, they get to define a certain role that they're interested in playing in an organization. And right now we have five different possible roles. The one that's probably most interesting to this audience is the role of master practitioner. It's what we call an uber geek. It's someone who's going to go out and be like a capital P programmer. It can be an engineer of the highest order. And the other four roles are a communicator, someone who maybe is on radio programs or writes books or is playing the role of an evangelist in an organization. Maybe a CIO is a form of communicator in that role. There's policymaker, and I have a list of five. I always remember four. So, master practitioner, communicator, policy
entrepreneur. I think you said
entrepreneur. Someone who's going to want to change the world, and then innovator. So most professors, when they're teaching classes, think of the students as being just like them. So innovators are like researchers. But students get to define these roles, and when they choose a role, they are going to be trained to be able to function in that role. Coming out of the university, and I'll tell you about how that works in a second. But let me tell you about threads, because threads are maybe the more innovative part of the program. Threads is an answer to the question of why am I taking a course, or why am I studying this material? A thread is a path through the undergraduate curriculum. It's a way of understanding why in my freshman year am I taking this course, in my junior year am I taking this class, in my senior year am I taking this class. We have eight threads that are defined. Let me give you an example of a thread. There's a thread, computing and information. It's what do you need to know in order to understand how information is used in organizations? So part of that is how is it stored. Part of it is how is it transmitted. Part of it is how is it valued. Part of it is how is it encrypted. Another example of a thread would be computing and people. How do computers and human beings interact? I'll give you another example would be computing and media. What do you need to know in order to use computers in a way to give people emotional experiences? It turns out you need to know a lot about computing. Like you might need to know how does display technology work, or how are media files, music files stored. But you also need to know a lot about people. You need to know about human perceptual systems. You need to know about how stories are told. What's a dramatic arc? What is there about Hamlet? So each one of these threads isn't a degree program in itself. It's a way of organizing the material around a topic. Another example would be computing and embodiment. It's what do you need to know if you want to put computation into a physical object? So you may need to know things about how sensors work, about noisy real-world data, about power issues. There are different sets of things. They're all computer science things, but they're different. The way we've got it set up is we have eight different threads that students can choose among. Each one is not a degree program, but if they choose two of them, and take the courses that are in those two threads, then they get a computer science undergraduate degree. And what we've done is made sure that that still makes them computer scientists. So any pair of these threads actually creates an ABET accredited degree for the students. And then students can define their careers in an interesting way. So I'll give you an example. Suppose a student takes the computing and people thread. So they learn a lot about how, for example, to run experiments using that involve people, so they can also understand what's going on with human cognitive load and what's going on with human perceptual systems so they can figure out how to build things that people can work with. And then they take computing and information, so they know how information is stored and they know how security works. So then these are the kinds of people that can come out and be able to build security systems that are actually usable by people. So it's not a narrow skill set, but it's a broad range of skills that enable them to work in a very special, in a special way within an organization.
Let's take a quick break, listeners. We'll be right back after these messages and talk about, first, the due diligence that would help a student identify which role would they be best suited for, and also the kind of thread that they should go after, which would help them specialize in a given broad area, which will still make them a specialist. And then followed by the fact that the immigration laws, coming back to our situation with the vacuum, the immigration laws that which are already making it tougher for the foreign IT workers, we already have acute shortage. We could have used some outside help, but guess what? Government is not helping either. So let's talk about these two points when we come back from the break, so please stay tuned.
The bottom line in business talk. Voice America Business.
April 1805. Bison as far as the eye can see. An abundance of bald eagle. Meriwether Lewis.
July 1805. We beheld a great number of antelope, deer, and elk. William Clark.
Imagine if Lewis and Clark's journals continued long past the end of their journey.
June 1905. Beaver trapped out. Buffalo herd down to a scant few.
How would they describe their trail today?
August 2005. The river is silent.
Would they be pleased?
On a more pleasant note, the new interstate certainly makes the commute more manageable.
Or would they feel differently?
Something must be done to save what's left of this great place.
As we commemorate the Lewis and Clark Bicentennial, consider what's been lost and what we can do to preserve what's left. Walk with them and see what you discover at www.lewisandclark200.org.
This is a public service message of the National Council of the Lewis and Clark Bicentennial, the Missouri Historical Society, and the Ad Council.
Looking for flexible ways to scale your IT efforts? Then visit www.aval.com today. Aval is a professional services firm with the mission to help companies align information technology with their business objectives through its full line of staffing and outsourcing services. Whether it's hiring top technology talent or developing mission-critical business solutions, we back it up with an unconditional, positive ROI guarantee. To find out how Aval can help your company, visit www.aval.com or call 1-800-947-2832. Aval, making IT better. www.aval.com. Visit today.
Keeping you a step ahead of the changing world of business, this is Voice America Business.
You are listening to CIO Talk Radio. If you have a question or comment, call toll-free 866-472-5790. Now back to the show. Here's Sanjo Gal.
Welcome back to the show, folks. For listeners who've just tuned in, today's topic is impending IT workforce vacuum. What's the plan? Our guests for today's show are Ed Lazowska and Dr. Merrick First. Ed is the Bill and Melinda Gates Chair, Computer Science and Engineering, University of Washington, and he's also the former co-chair, President Bush's Information Technology Advisory Committee. Dr. Merrick is the Distinguished Professor and Associate Dean of the College of Computing at Georgia Tech. Before the break, and follow-up to Dr. Merrick's answer, the question was that what's the due diligence that is done in order for the university to help a student understand which role are they best suited for, or they would just try a couple of different roles and then they would go ahead and, you know, pick up the one which they feel, you know, best for. And also followed up with that is the question where, coming to our workforce vacuum situation, in the immigration laws that are becoming tougher for foreign IT workers, and while we need people who can very well be supplemented by folks from outside, that's becoming tougher, so which is making situation worse. So what is happening there? So let's start with the due diligence first.
Right. Well, what's happening, Ed pointed out at the break, that what's happening with people with skills in computing is that they're not going into very narrow job categories. They're spreading out into the IT workforce and the workforce in general in very broad ways. So when people think about themselves as wanting to do computing, they don't necessarily, like they did maybe only 5 or 10 years ago, think, I want to work on compilers or I want to work on databases, where they sort of fit themselves into the IT value stack at some particular place, and they try to learn everything they can about that narrow place. Now they're thinking about themselves as going into an entire industry or taking a cut at bringing value in some more, as I said, horizontal way. It turns out that the 8 threads we've defined, different people may define different threads, fit for the kinds of students that we're seeing at Georgia Tech, and we know that because we went out and surveyed them. It also fits for the kinds of employees that the people who are hiring people from Georgia Tech are looking for. It also happens to fit for our faculty.
Let me make one other comment. I think that a student in high school inevitably has a stereotypical view of every career, whether it's civil engineer or computer scientist or physicist or psychologist. You probably in high school don't have a view of the breadth of what you can do with an education in any of those fields. It's part of the job of a university or college to open a student's eyes to the breadth of possibilities. And I think that's what computer science programs have not done an aggressive job of. We leave it to the students to discover it for themselves. And what Georgia Tech has done is to lay out on paper and in reality in their curriculum the full breadth of possibilities that the field affords. And that allows students who arrive at Georgia Tech interested in computing or interested in some allied field to take a look at these threads and roles and say, gee, as a computer scientist, the whole world is available to me, and I can think about what I want to do with my life. And furthermore, since threads are relatively lightweight, they can say partway into this, hey, I'm going to pick up this other thread. I'm going to emphasize this direction. But it really opens students' eyes to what the possibilities are.
What you're saying is completely true, and we've even validated this with surveys of the students. The high school students actually they come in two flavors. There are those that think computer science is programming, and there are those that have no idea.
Right.
There's like no other type. And when they come to campus, of course, computer science, of course, is not just programming, and computer science is incredibly broad. So we go through a process with them. We've actually invented a process called the freshman leap process, where part of their education is explaining to them what these threads are, what the threads mean. We do that by presenting them heroes, people who are the kinds of people who they might become if they were to pursue more deeply a particular type of thread. And we also talk to them about the job opportunities that the various threads represent. And that's a process for them that goes on for a year or two as they figure out which, as Ed pointed out, as they figure out which threads make the most sense for them.
Let me mention a University of Washington example of the sort of breadth that Merrick's talking about. For a number of years, we've had a really successful undergraduate program in digital animation, which is taught by faculty from art and music and computer science and from people in the animation industry to students from all of those fields. And what makes these students valuable is that when they then go to a Pixar or a PDI, a company in the digital animation industry, they understand all aspects of the process. That is, just as Merrick said a while ago, they understand the storytelling and they understand the technology. And that sort of broad appreciation is what makes people valuable. And it's our job to expose students to that sort of breadth and help them make choices that allow them to go off into careers that are going to get stronger and stronger over time rather than weaker and weaker.
Right, and choice is actually a very interesting word. So for the Gen X and the Gen Y folks, one of the things I can tell you for sure is true, and this is actually very important in the workforce, not just here, they like choice. I mean, they live in a world in which they can change the channel on their television set and they can flip to a different website every 30 seconds. In fact, one of the problems is they don't want to come to a university and choose a major that they're going to have to last through for 4 years. So doing anything you can to provide them an opportunity to choose is really good from their point of view. They like choice. They like being able to move from place to place. And one of the things we have to think about in terms of what kinds of jobs we're providing or how these jobs are structured is what these students are looking for, what the workers are looking for. They're not looking to go into a very narrow role and stay in that narrow role for their entire careers. That's just not the life that they're living right now.
Right. It's funny for Merrick and I to say this because we're both people who've been in the same job for a long period of time. But there was a study a decade ago that said that computer specialists had a shorter average time in job than anybody except short order cook. So what that means is that many people these days, instead of going to work for General Motors and being there for life, or General Electric, or General something else, you know, they're really in a job because it's exciting for a couple of years and because it's going to help them develop a set of skills that move them on to the next job. It's a mentality that's hard for 50-year-olds to get around, but it really is how many of the smartest kids think these days.
Now, to your point, do you think it is actually a good idea to create the educational structure which is centered around finding them a way to quickly find one job and then switch to another at a heartbeat?
Well, let's not phrase this in terms of job hopping. Let's phrase it in terms of the acquisition of skills and abilities. You want to be producing students who are constantly growing and constantly learning, and that's how they avoid getting offshored, bluntly. You know, back to offshoring for a second. This is back to the 20 minutes ago in the show. But, you know, I don't want to be too political about this, but if you look at U.S. employment, for example, in 1800, 98% of the people who worked in America worked on the farm. And in 1900, it was still 40%. Now, over time, that's been good for our economy. It's extremely dislocating if you're a family farmer and your farm shuts down. But for the economy as a whole, those people who used to be farmers are now computer scientists and radio talk show hosts and lawyers and real estate dealers. And, you know, they've moved up the economic ladder, and we have to keep doing that in this country. That's the challenge for us. It is the case that that years ago in this country we had a set of social structures that took care of the people who were dislocated. And those social structures, for example, our healthcare system, are not as robust as they once were. So I think that's a source of jeopardy for people and a source of justifiable fear. It is, how am I going to be able to keep my family going if I need to change careers? And like many other aspects of our lives, it's an area where we have to take more individual responsibility, which means put yourself in a position where you're going to be able to keep learning and keep advancing.
Well, and the answer is to not focus on developing a skill which will, over time, be devalued. So if you focus on getting a very narrow skill that someone can do no matter where they are in the world, and it's in some very circumscribed way, that is not going to be a very safe a safe career path for you.
Amen.
One of the things I was going to say, too, about this changing landscape we're in where outsourcing is possible, I'm looking at it and I'm watching something else happen, which maybe we're just in the beginning edge of this. Right now, it's so easy to get software and IT built relatively cheaply anywhere. You don't even need to know where it is. You can just go to Rent-A-Coder websites and post what project you want to have built. But if you want to build something new, if you want to create some new artifact or some new kind of business, you're not reliant on your own skill. What you're really reliant on is your ability to see how these pieces will fit together and bring value. This year alone, out of our graduating freshman class, five of the students that I know of, and there may well be more, have already started companies while they were seniors, and they built the companies, they built the software for the companies in exactly this way. They had an idea for a business, and they located people on the web, and they had no idea who they were or even where they were. They hired out the technology, and they got this thing started, and a couple of these are already profitable. So I think that's probably the future. You want to be able to produce people who can even go into large organizations and get the same kind of thing to happen. You want to give people the problem of solve this problem. It's not so much you want to give them this little piece of code to write or this particular piece of IT system to run. You want to say solve the problem. And one of the things they're going to be able to bring to bear is the ability to outsource, and whether that's outsourcing to someplace in rural America or outsourcing to someplace in a city in India, it doesn't matter. It's just part of the skill set that people need to bring to these jobs.
Let me turn to immigration, which you also mentioned as a topic, and I think it's important. There's a complementary set of articles, complementary to Tom Friedman's book, by a gentleman named Richard Florida. And the first of these articles was called "The World is Spiky," right, as opposed to flat. And what Florida points out is that if you draw take a map of the world and draw a density plot represented by spires of anything from where are patents generated to where are scientific papers that are widely cited, written, to where is electric power consumed, this is not flat at all. It exists in spires. And In the United States, those spires or spikes are in Seattle, Northern California, Southern California, New England, the Washington, D.C. area, Atlanta. Those are where those spires or spikes are. That's where it's happening. And while there is this globalization going on, there is an enormous benefit to being in one of the regions where it's happening. And I could talk about Seattle, America, could talk about Atlanta. There really is an enormous advantage to geographic proximity and proximity to venture capital and proximity to suppliers and intellectual partners. And our goal has got to be to make the United States and the regions within the United States to continue to be one of the world's spires. Historically, in computing, as in all other fields, flexible immigration policies have played an enormously important role. We still compute today on what are called von Neumann computers, computers that use von Neumann architecture that he devised in the 1940s at Princeton. Von Neumann was an immigrant. I'm serving on a National Academy study group right now concerning the innovation pipeline and information technology. And it's co-chaired by Eric Benamou, who is, among other things, the chairman of the board of 3Com. But Eric is an immigrant from France. This nation has been built by immigrants. And when our immigration policies deny entrance to those people, we jeopardize our future competitiveness, and we jeopardize the strength of American companies, and we force those companies to go offshore seeking talent. It's utterly crazy.
Well, and we're seeing, I mean, we're definitely seeing that just even anecdotally on the ground in two ways. One, it's much more difficult for students to arrive here and join us as either undergraduates or graduate students, which means that our pool of talent is shrinking. And at the same time that that's happening, that's forcing these people to have to create opportunities for themselves at home. And then the second part is because of the immigration difficulties in the sense that things are tightening or becoming more difficult, people who were graduating here, who were originally from overseas, instead of staying here because they think that's their best option, they're actually finding that it's much better for them, either financially or just in terms of access to talent, to go back home. And so we're doubly defeating ourselves. So now we're making it possible for us to train people who can then train others. Those people are then going back home and discovering that they have people to train because we're not letting the people who would want to be trained here come here. So we're really shooting ourselves twice by this kind of immigration policy.
Now let's look at the fact that while we have been looking at this baby boomers retiring and they would be out of the workforce and we'll have a vacuum, but it is not 100% accurate because most of them, when they were surveyed, it seems like they don't want to, they don't want to stop, and they want to continue to work. But the only thing what they want is no longer 9-to-5 schedule. They would rather have the freedom that they always long for, they used to long for, and now they want to come in as consultants or for whatever role that they could best work with. So with that being said, if this problem is can be to quite an extent solved by just making these guys be available yet again, but in a more flexible schedule format, then this could actually get us by a couple of more years till the time our, at least the new entrants become a little more mature, and the gap between the mid-management and the number of senior management roles that were to be filled, that would not be as serious a situation. But in order for us to do that, what is being done to keep all these baby boomers in the right spirit so that they are ready to help and come back and work with the same set of companies with all the business knowledge that they have, and they spend the time with the mid-management and the junior folks to transfer the knowledge?
So let me divert this just a bit for a second, and then we'll come back to the question you asked. I want to reemphasize that the workforce gap in IT is due even more to the creation of new jobs than to retirements. 71% of all newly created jobs in all fields of science and engineering between now and 2014 will be in computing. And 60% of all new jobs and of all available jobs due to new job creation and retirements in all fields of science and engineering. So if we could retain everyone who might retire in the next 10 years in the workforce, we would still have an enormous workforce gap in information technology because of the creation of new jobs in this country. But just really important for folks to realize that the demand is expanding enormously, and this doesn't even fully account for the people who are using their computer science and information technology skills in fields ranging from biology to finance. You know, they're not maybe being programmers. Maybe they're working in biology labs, taking advantage of the fact that biology is really in every way an information science today, and computer science training perfectly positions you to drive advances in biology, even if you're not writing programs anymore. So people really need to realize this diversity.
And maybe I can tell you something that I know about what's going on overseas, less than what I know about is going on here. So when companies in emerging nations that are facing this problem in a slightly different way, they're looking for ways to get more senior people when they didn't have senior people in the first place. It's the same problem. So if we have companies here where the senior people are retiring, then we need to replace them. But if you have a company overseas where the senior people don't even exist, then how do you create them? There's a lot of focus. We've been spending a lot of time, for example, in Korea recently and also in India, on finding ways to take people who are at one level in the IT workforce and then rapidly advance them to the next higher level in the IT workforce, and do that by creating educational programs with organizations like Georgia Tech, University of Washington, others that have an international reach. It's not something that I'm hearing very much about from companies inside the United States, but I can tell you that it's something that other governments and other companies outside the United States are spending a lot of money on. So maybe that's an opportunity that we're missing in the States.
Now, coming to the point that workers from different eras require different type of challenges in work environments and the culture, they have to be all given those specific, environment so that they enjoy working at a given company. Are organizations sophisticated enough that they are able to recognize those individual levels of expectations? For example, you would take baby boomers. They used to come in a given company, start as a fresh graduate, and retire as one of the senior guys there. Then Gen X would be there who want a work-life balance, a whole lot more. Your new entrants, the new college graduates, want to be aggressive. They've got one eye on their career, and then they want to really know what are they working for, what is in it for them in the long haul, or even in the couple of years down the line. So with all that being said, how is an organization supposed to have the juggling act going all the time where you've got people from three different generations being working in IT, and all also in other roles, but still they are different type of people, different fabric. So that's a challenge. How are we dealing with that?
Take it away, Merrick.
Yeah, I was going to say it's a really good question, and I've seen it. I've seen it pretty much break up the way that you've described it. And there seems to be it's a cultural and it's almost like a language gap. I've seen people try to manage Gen Xers or Gen Y folk, and I've seen people want to pull their hair out because, what do you mean you're not showing up to work today because you're going skiing? What about this deadline we have? It's definitely a challenge. I mean, my gut tells me that the marketplace is very Darwinian, and those that figure it out are going to be successful, and those that aren't figuring it out are not going to be successful. I can also tell you, having just come back from a long trip in Korea and visiting Samsung and LG, that the level of intensity and talent and training in the workforce within those walls is so great and is so different from what I'm seeing at comparable companies in the United States that it left me gasping for air and thinking that we're really we're going to have to do a lot of running to catch up. And so maybe on the one hand, if we have the generation that wants those kinds of lifestyles and that way of looking at the world, there may be a rude awakening because it may not be possible to function in a competitive environment if that's the attitude you bring to work. So I don't know the answer to this.
It's a tough one, I know. But on behalf of the show and our listeners, I'd like to thank you, Ed and Merrick, for sharing your thoughts and insights about how organizations that are businesses, academia, and government can collaborate to effectively deal with this problem related to IT workforce vacuum. And definitely thank you for sharing the insights so as to how at least the new entrants are being taught, so we can at least be hopeful of the new generation, which is going to come out, would be far more, you can say, targeting their career and the way they work towards solving business problems just versus just becoming a geek.
Good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you.
Thank you again. As a country, we have been taking pride in our ability to innovate and be at the forefront of technology. However, thought and idea leadership needs to be coupled with effective execution to achieve success. Now, the impending IT workforce vacuum is a serious issue, and concrete steps are to be taken to fight it. Starting from government regulations pertaining to immigration, to college education, as American Ed discussed, to the internal training and knowledge transfer among baby boomers, Gen X, and the new generation, everything needs to happen simultaneously in an impeccable manner in order for us to be able to prevent this time bomb from exploding. What's your organization doing to deal with IT workforce vacuum issues? Please send us your story at views@ciotalkradio.com. That is views@ciotalkradio.com. Thank you again for listening to CIO Talk Radio. This is Sanjog Gall, your talk show host. Till next week, take care and God bless.
The Bottom Line.
Thank you for tuning in to CIO Talk Radio. Please join Sanjog Gall next Friday at 8 a.m. Pacific Time for another hour of CIO Talk Radio, right here on the Bottom Line of Business Talk, Voice America Business.